The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pod of thunder and rock and roll. Rock and roll Twilight Zone. We're going to get to that, but hang on to your hats and glasses. This is the wildest ride in the wilderness. The Duff McKagan joke of the week. Here you go.
Hi, Chris Jericho. It's Duff McKagan calling. How are you doing, Chris Jericho? I'm one of the day. Tofu. I'll use it, Chris, in a sentence. Hey, I want to suck on your tofu.
Thank you. Bye.
Tofu. All right. If you think you got a better sentence for Duff's word than this, tofu, tweet it to me at Talk is Jericho. And some of you did send some alternate sentences for last week's Duff McKagan word of the day slash joke of the week, which was Wakanda. And I got to share this one. At M. Pardowski tweeted, Fozzie Wakanda stage, rock like it's the last day of the world. Fozzie walk off the stage. So, good one. If you got one for tofu, tweet it to me at Talk is Jericho and we'll read it right here on the show. And thanks to always to Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Duff McKagan for taking the time to entertain us with his bad jokes and equally bad word of the day every single Friday. And speaking of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, today's guest is not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but he knows a lot about some of the mysteries and conspiracies surrounding some of rock's biggest legends and Hall of Famers. Richard Syrett, home of the Rock and Roll Twilight Zone, newest show right here on the Jericho Network. Rich Syrett is here to share some of those fascinating stories with us, kicking it off with the Rock and Roll Twilight Zone is all about right here on the Jericho Network. We're going to touch on the death of Jimi Hendrix. Was it murder? Suicide? Accidental as reported? We're not sure. Rich will dig deep into this great mystery on his own podcast, available now. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts. Check it out. He's going to give us a special preview today on Talk is Jericho. He's also going to run down the 27 Club, the great musicians who died at the age of 27, like Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Brian Jones of the Stones, Kurt Cobain. Crazy how long this list is. Wait till you hear it all in its entirety. He's got some great info on all the weird coincidences and the alleged curse surrounding the Buddy Holly plane crash that killed Buddy Holly, the Big Bopper, and Richie Valens some 50 years ago. Stories are fascinating. If you really want to get more details about some of the stuff we touched on today, you got to check out Rich's podcast, Rock and Roll Twilight Zone. Like I said, brand new on the Jericho Network. You can subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, TuneIn, or just ask Alexa to play it for you on your smart speaker. So Richard Syrett and the Rock and Roll Twilight Zone coming up. But first, coming up, Fozzie on the Judas Rising Tour in San Diego tonight with Iced Earth, March 9th at the House of Blues. Through Fire, Santa Cruz are joining us that night. And for the rest of the tour, just Iced Earth at San Diego tonight. And then tomorrow, Los Angeles at the Whiskey. March 11th, Sunday at the Counts Vamped in Las Vegas. March 13th, San Francisco at Slim's. March 15th, Portland, Oregon. And March 16th, Seattle, Washington. Then we're going to Milwaukee, Chicago, Grand Rapids, Detroit, Dayton, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Clifton Park, New York, Philly, Portland, Hampton Beach. And don't forget Hampton Beach at Wally's. We're going to do an early show, 5 p.m., and then we are going to watch WrestleMania together. That's right, together we're going to watch it at Wally's after the Fozzie Rock show, April 8th. Get your tickets now at FozzieRock.com and come join us for the VIP meet and greet. Fozzie's got the best VIP experience in rock. We do a live concert for you, take requests even, take pictures with you, sign autographs, we meet you, we greet you, we retreat you. Everything you want to do, all available at FozzieRock.com. All right, coming to you now, live rock and roll Twilight Zone with Richard Syrett right here on Talk Is Jericho. Here we go.
So it's interesting. So one of my most critically acclaimed shows was a few months ago. It was the Paul Is Dead, Another Rock and Roll Conspiracies or Legends with our Gary Patterson. I'm here with Rich Syrett. And you were Gary's partner.
That's right.
Because I think if you guys remember, if you didn't listen to the show, 2 weeks after I interviewed Gary, he passed away very suddenly. So his interview with me on Talk Is Jericho was his last interview as far as I know. I think as far as maybe anybody knows.
It was. And, you know, ultimately, Gary had a great sense of humor because you were talking about the whole Paul Is Dead rumor, which is how Gary really made his mark with The Walrus Was Paul.
He wrote a book about it, right.
And Gary and I talked endlessly about Sergeant Pepper and all the clues.
Right.
Well, when does Gary decide to check out? But May 26th, the anniversary of the release, 50 years to the day.
No kidding.
Yes.
Wow, I did not realize that.
So he had the last laugh.
You know, it was funny because some people were pointing out, I mean, nothing funny, but I think the sense of humor that Gary had, like you said, it was funny in that a couple people on Twitter were like, are you sure he's really dead?
Exactly.
Did he maybe fake his own death just to build up the podcast? You know, and it was very timely in that respect.
Yes. Well, a couple of upsides. One, he didn't join the 27 Club.
Right, yeah.
We wish he stayed longer, but he was 67. And number two, he's finally going to get to meet all of these icons that he talked about endlessly. I think he will be a little upset, though, that the only instrument they have up there is a harp because he loved his guitar.
There's no rock and roll harp players.
Not that I know of.
But that's, I mean, like, it was, I told you a little bit earlier, like, I've been looking for someone like Gary for a while to do a show, more specifically on the Paul McCartney conspiracy of being dead and all that sort of stuff. But then he, you know, I read his books, but he told me a couple other very cool stories, and we were saying, oh, we got to do a part two. He's like, oh, I got stories about this and this and this, and there's so much there. And that's why I wanted to talk to you today, because you're kind of carrying on his legacy of being maybe now the expert in rock and roll legends and conspiracies and mythos and that sort of thing.
Well, huge shoes to fill. I was never a musician, but I'm just a huge fan of
huge rock and
of
roll
rock
fan.
And roll
gotcha,
fan.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Gary, as you know, filled volumes with these sorts of things. And rock and roll, I mean, from its beginning, was just ripe for these types of legends, you know, live hard, die young, leave a good corpse. And in some cases, you know, these corpses are still wandering around haunting different locations. And just the birth of rock and roll, you know, coming from Appalachia and the Mississippi Delta, both those regions just steeped in folklore and really a deep belief in the paranormal. Mm. So the marriage, the blending of the two, always meant to be.
The whole concept of kind of one of the pioneers of rock and roll, Robert Johnson, you know, the whole Crossroads legend. If you don't even know it, you've heard it. Robert Johnson went down to the crossroads, sold his soul to the devil, that he'd become a big musician, star in rhythm and blues at the time, and then it would die at 27.
Right, Robert Johnson, yeah, some consider him the grandfather of rock and roll.
Sure, right.
And couldn't play a lick. He used to chase after Son House and ask him to teach him a few things, and Son didn't want anything to do with him. All of a sudden, Robert Johnson disappears for several months, I guess, up to a year, depending on which version of the story. He comes back, and my gosh, he's just turning heads. He's playing in all the juke joints and just blowing people away. Mm-hmm. And he would play with his back to the audience, which kind of added to the mystery because he didn't want to give away these licks that supposedly had been taught to him by the devil. And he told people that he was taking lessons and learning to play in cemeteries. And perhaps ultimately made the deal with the Old Scratch, as they call him, somewhere around Cleveland or Ruleville, Mississippi. Yeah.
To become a star. But so what I wanted to say is you were going to do a show about this sort of things with Gary. Is that kind of, because you emailed me after Gary passed away and said, you know, I have this idea of what I was going to do with him and I want to continue on.
Gary and I had been fast friends for almost 20 years, mostly over the radio, over the phone. And then we got occasion to meet a few times, sat down and decided, why don't the two of us get together and put a program together that talks about what he's written about for years, what I've talked about for years on the radio. A blending, we called it Spirit of Rock Radio, Rock and Roll Meets the Twilight Zone. And we had been working on this for 2 years, and we're getting very close to finally launching on terrestrial radio. And just days before we were to meet with a radio station down in Knoxville, I learned you had been on Coast to Coast AM with our colleague.
Dave was hosting, right?
Dave was hosting. I got a Facebook message from him Saturday morning. And he said, just wanted you to know, Gary passed away. And my first instinct was, that's absolute nonsense. I just talked to him last night. So immediately I called Gary. I said, what the hell is going on? And
he didn't answer.
He did not. But I checked my phone records on my iPhone, and it said that I had no outgoing or incoming calls on Friday. That night, I was so sure, Chris, that I had talked to him, because we talked several times a week. He had called me on the Thursday to say the meeting is on for Monday, which happened to be Memorial Day. And I said, we were both very excited. And then he called me, I was certain again, Friday, to tell me, no, Monday's Memorial Day, there's no meeting. And then he said a few things that were kind of odd. First of all, and this isn't about, you know, pumping myself up, but he said, you know, Richard, you and I are a really big deal. I think he was trying to pump us both up. And then he said, you're a super cool dad. I thought, where is this coming from? Very strange. So my last words to him was, I wished him a happy Memorial Day weekend, and I said, are you having a barbecue? And Gary said very emphatically, which was very strange in retrospect, there will be no barbecue. So, I'm not gonna press that issue. I don't know what's going on there. So then I was sure again that was Friday. Then I get the Facebook message from Dave Schrader at Coast, and I checked my messages, nothing on Friday. I went upstairs and I talked to my wife. I said, Gary just died. And without me prompting her, she said, you talked to him last night. And I said, I was so certain, but there's no ingoing, outgoing calls.
Wow.
She said, well, you were talking to somebody because you walked through the kitchen with the phone to your ear. And you see, she said, you had a kind of a distant look on your face, and I didn't follow up to ask you who you were talking to. Hmm. And she said, I assumed it was Gary. So that was probably around 7 or 8 o'clock. I went down to the funeral in near Knoxville. I find out Gary had passed around 6 o'clock very suddenly on that Friday. So I went up to his brother to express my condolences. And I said, you know, one of the last things Gary said to me was when I asked him about, are you going to have a barbecue on Memorial Day? And he said, there will be no barbecue. And he said, that's funny, because that Friday, Gary went out and spent about $500 on a brand new barbecue.
Hmm.
So am I misremembering this, Chris? Is my wife misremembering it? I don't know. I mean, I'm not inclined to necessarily believe in telephone calls from the dead. And if he was going to call anybody, it would probably be a close family member. Why me? I don't know. But there you have it.
Hmm. Very, very strange, right? But also, too, like you said, I've always found from doing a lot of paranormal shows here on Talk is Jericho that when you have somebody who has kind of that, I'm going to say like a conduit, there's a vibe there, things like this happen. Like you said, passing away on May 26th, the 50th anniversary of Sgt. Pepper, when, you know, his last recorded interview is about Sgt. Pepper and the Beatles, etc.
Right.
You know, who's to say? Who's to say? I mean, it does. I'm not going to tell you that you're crazy, because it would make perfect sense if it happened. You know what I mean?
It would make almost too much sense. And I've stopped sort of, you know, dismissing these things out of hand, because there's just it. When you become immersed in this whole arena, I don't know what you just start maybe connecting the dots. Maybe there's a psychological term for when you see things that aren't necessarily there. You're seeing patterns and so forth. Maybe I'm a little guilty of that. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say, since I've been on this beat more or less for the last 20 years, you know, the odd thing like that happens once in a while. And if you pay attention and, you know,
I think that's a great point. If you pay attention,
yeah.
If your mind is open to it, like, this is a completely different thing, but I think you understand, like, I started doing yoga about 5 years ago, and it really cured all that ailed me. And my wife did it, and she didn't really believe in it. It didn't do anything for her. I believed it would work. I wanted it to work. I needed it to work, and it worked. I was paying attention to the signs.
Right.
And I think it's the same with paranormal and this sort of thing. If you're watching for the signs, you'll see a lot of stuff that most people don't, because it's hiding in plain sight right in front of you.
Sure. And I don't know a lot about yoga. My wife is also, mm-hmm. she's into hot yoga, and it's all about concentrating on the breath, and you're concentrating, you're focused on the breath sure. coming in and the breath going out. And so you're really experiencing sort of the ever-present now. You're mm-hmm. really in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So as a performer, I can see that absolutely essential for sure. someone like yourself. Sure. But I guess, yeah, if you're experiencing that ever-present now, then sort of the distinction between the past and the future, that sort of stuff kind of disappears. And mm-hmm. we enter this, you know, this time loop. There is no future. There is no past. There is only the now. And so, you know, communicating with someone who we think is beyond the veil,
yeah.
that sort of stuff, maybe it's far more possible mm-hmm. if you're in the ever-present now.
So your idea now is to continue the spirit of radio with on your own, obviously.
I came back from the funeral sort of questioning whether it should just die along with Gary. And I thought, no, that's not what Gary would want. And I really want this too. And I became convinced that it's what he wanted. It's what I want. So yeah, I'm gonna give it a twirl and see if we can this happen.
Let's talk about some stuff that you'll talk about in Spirit of the Radio. Because like I said, last time with Gary, it was just riveting to me, all the stories that we spoke about, Paul and beyond. So tell me some of the things that you want to kind of explore.
Well, the first episode is about Jimi Hendrix, and I don't just focus on, you know, the macabre elements. The show is also celebrating the music and the life of these individuals, and then interwoven in there are these elements of what I call the woo-woo. Mm-hmm. So with Jimi Hendrix, obviously, you know, we talk about how he was just, you know, light years ahead of his time and playing as Juma.
To this day.
Yes. Juma Sultan, I interviewed Juma Sultan, who played percussion, the congas for him at Woodstock in his new band after Noel Redding and Mitch Mitchell had left.
Right? Yeah.
That's right. This one was Gypsy Sun and Rainbows at Woodstock. And Juma Sultan played congas there and also on the Dick Cavett Show with him, and he talked about Hendrix was playing the music of the spheres, just, you know, just so out there, hearing notes that nobody even dreamed of, mm-hmm. you know, and colors and things like this. But so we celebrate the music, but we also talk about, obviously, his passing in September of 1970. And
just let me say this, I had his stepbrother Leon was on this show and said he doesn't believe the reports of how Jimmy died. He said there was some very strange things afoot.
Yeah, it seems as time goes on, and I think as people get closer to sort of meeting their maker, they feel the burden to relieve them or unburden themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we have, for example, people that performed the autopsy now apparently speaking out, talking about the presence of red wine in Jimmy's in his stomach.
Mm.
But not a lot in his bloodstream. They found like bottles of wine. It was in his hair when they picked him up from the
The official cause of death was drug overdose?
Yeah, barbiturates.
Okay, gotcha.
And asphyxiation on his own vomit.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
As a result of the barbiturates. Okay. So they found all this red wine in his hair, but mainly in his stomach and then in his esophagus. So the question is, how does he have all this red wine in his stomach? In his lungs, rather. Mm-hmm. Apologies. In his lungs, but not in his bloodstream.
Wow. Okay.
Well, we also know from Jimi Hendrix's associates and friends, he didn't even drink red wine. So enter his...
I have a little glass of vodka here as we talk. It's very rock and roll.
All right.
So if you hear the pouring, that's it. It's not red wine. So go ahead.
So Jimmy's final hours...
He didn't even drink red wine, you said.
Those are the reports. He did not drink red wine. So he's staying at the Samarkand Hotel in London, in the Notting Hill district, with his girlfriend, Monica Daneman. And when he's found, he's alone in the apartment, in the hotel. Ambulance picks him up. They take him back to the hospital to try to revive him, St. Martin Hospital. No luck. He dies at around 12:45 p.m. And again, all this red wine. Now, enter his road manager, the late James Tappy Wright, who I spoke to and told me that his road manager, Tappy Wright, tells me that his manager, Mike Jeffrey, is a former MI6 agent. He served in the Suez Crisis in 1956.
MI6 is the English Secret Service?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, this guy's essentially an assassin. Mm. He's a hired killer. He can kill you with his bare hands.
Okay.
So Jeffrey was incredibly controlling over Jimi Hendrix, and Hendrix's life insurance policy had been taken. This is not uncommon. A manager will take out a life insurance policy on his star. The recording company would as well. But his contract with Jeffrey was also about to expire. And Mike Jeffrey had borrowed heavily from the mob, according to James Tappy Wright, in order to build, to buy and build Electric Land Studios in New York.
So, Jimmy's studio.
That's right. Yeah. Now, Jimi Hendrix, if he walks away after his contract with him expires, Mike Jeffrey's left holding the bag. So the question is then, what happened in those hours when Monica Daneman left the apartment, leaving Jimi Hendrix alone on the bed, fully clothed, dead? Before, you know, what happened in those, in that missing time? Did someone come in? Did they pour red wine down Jimi Hendrix's throat, essentially drowning him? He drowned in red wine.
Really?
That seems to be the opinion of not only people like Juma Sultan and James Tappy Wright, but also you know, other researchers, people that have talked to medical examiners and so forth.
So how do you drown on red wine?
Well, if you hold someone's head just the right way and hold their, tilt their head back and pour the wine down their throat, it's a little bit like waterboarding.
I was going to say that. It's like waterboarding,
like waterboarding. Now, who would have that kind of knowledge? Someone like his manager.
Wow.
Now, Mike Jeffrey is no longer with us. He died mysteriously in a plane crash himself in 1973. The only thing they found was his Rolex. So maybe he's out there.
Right.
We don't know. But it's a mystery. I don't know that we'll ever fully know the answer, but people are starting to talk.
Mm-hmm. So you're thinking that maybe he would have drugged Jimmy and then drowned him with the wine, or is Jimmy still alive struggling, or what's the theory?
The theory is the Monica Daneman, again, she's no longer with us, not here to defend herself, but the theory is, and again, this comes from James Tappy Wright, that she probably slipped him something just so that he could be easily sort of, you know, that he could be subdued. She slips out, says she's going for a pack of smokes, leaves the apartment wide open. In comes the wet team, I guess is the term they would use. And now what does she do when she comes back to the hotel? Does she call the police? Does she call? No, she calls Eric Burdon, who's in London, who's dating her girlfriend. Eric Burdon comes over.
Singer of the Animals.
Animals. And apparently they clean up and hide some things. I'm not sure. Then Eric Burdon goes on national television and says he believes it was a suicide. Well, now Jimmy's record label are coming to, they're threatening to sue Eric Burdon because if it was a suicide, then the life insurance policy is null and void.
Right.
Mike Jeffrey was incensed that Eric Burdon would come out and say that as well. So then he recanted and changed his tune very quickly.
Unbelievable, the timing of all this. So just let me kind of get this all straight for the layman's terms. So Jimmy has the contract with the manager. The manager is tied up with hundreds of thousands of dollars or a big amount of money in Jimmy's studio.
Right.
And Jimmy's contract is coming up.
So it was money he borrowed from the mob.
So was the kind of consensus that Jimmy was going to leave his management contract and go find another manager, or we don't know?
Not 100% certain, but Jimmy was, he talked to some of the women in his life, people like Kathy Etchingham and others. He was not happy. Jeffrey was, he had this routine where he would put Jimmy in a particular situation. 1969, Hendrix comes into Toronto. He's busted for possession of heroin. Jimmy swore up and down that he had kicked it. He didn't even have the paraphernalia
the
with
apparatus
him.
For it.
Didn't have the tracks on his arms, anything. So the theory, again, this is James Tappy Wright in the interview, says that this is Mike's MO, Mike Jeffrey. He would plant stuff like that so that he could come riding in like the cavalry and rescue Jimmy and say to Jimmy, see, without me, you're nowhere. You're in big trouble. This was the way he operated, and he was good at it.
It's interesting, Stephen, just you mentioned, it's so funny how tied in Toronto is to rock and roll history, even with Keith Richards getting busted for heroin and almost, you know, going to jail in Toronto.
Yeah, it's like a nexus. Yeah, you know, places like Memphis and London and L.A., of course,
right,
with the Sunset Strip in Toronto. Sure, tremendous.
I think the Stones still always rehearse in Toronto before every tour they do in North America.
They do, and there's the El Macombo Club where they played and recorded "Love You Live" back in 1977. They love playing Toronto. Their promoters, the Glimmer, or the promoters up until recently promoted their tours, are based in Toronto.
Do you know that story of Keith and the heroin bustin'?
Well, I believe that they ended up, what I remember was they ended up coming and playing a charity concert east of here in Oshawa.
For the blind.
For the blind. That's right.
So Keith has this huge heroin possession charge where he's facing like 15 years in jail, to where even reading Keith's book, he was like, okay, the Stones have to get another guitar player because I'm going away.
Right.
And the judge, they worked it out. So all he had to do was play a concert for the blind.
That's right. Talk about nine lives. Yeah, that could have been the end of the Stones.
Yeah,
right,
I love
there.
70s rock and roll. I was going to ask you, too, is it hard, Rich, when you're Hendrix died in 69, 70?
70.
70, so that's almost 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And you're mentioning this person's passed away and that person's passed away. I mean, is it hard to still find people that are alive that know these sort of things?
It's going to get to that point. I mean, mm-hmm. It's almost like I'm in a race with The Undertaker in certain circumstances because James Tappy Wright just passed away.
Oh, wow.
So
after you spoke to him.
After I spoke to him. But there, you know, we're talking about musicians in many cases that died in their prime, 27 Club again.
Yeah.
So they have family members, they have friends that are still, you know, not ancient by any stretch. You have record producers, there's enough people out there. You know, thank God there's enough of the legends still out there in the South, still doing it at 75 for crying out loud.
For sure, and doing it great.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed, also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Let me ask you this. You've mentioned a couple times the 27 Club.
Yes.
Let's go through who's in the set. I mean, I'm sure you don't know everybody, or maybe you do. There's quite a few.
Well, we have to start with Robert Johnson.
Robert Johnson. These are all musicians that died at 27 years of age.
That's right.
It's almost the cursed year. If you're a rock and roll musician, you make it past 27, you're doing good.
That's right. When you think about it, it's, you know, with all apologies to coal miners and I guess, you know,
lumberjacks,
craft fishermen, it's probably the, you know, it's one of the most dangerous occupations going.
So you said Robert Johnson.
So we have Robert Johnson. And then we have, it was kind of a real cluster in the late 60s into the 70s. We had Brian Jones, ex of the Stones in 1969. Then, of course, you had Jim Morrison. Well, we should back up Janis Joplin, then Jimi Hendrix, then Jim Morrison, all 27. I guess if you want to come a little closer to home, we have people like Kurt Cobain. You know, the list is probably close to 100 people. And they're not just, you know, names that you would immediately jump out to you. There's a lot of sort of lesser knowns, you know, like the side men and the guys who get the notoriety.
And stuff
exactly.
That,
Yeah.
It's just so one of those weird coincidences that you wonder, you know, is it a coincidence or is it something more deeper than that, right?
The way that numbers play in this whole space of rock and roll and the paranormal is just remarkable. John Lennon and the number 9, he's haunted by the number 9.
Let's talk about that. You mentioned John Lennon and talking about, I'm just actually going to look up the 27 Club here and find out some others. But tell us about John Lennon. You mentioned that there was something going on with his assassination and kind of all the stuff that went on at that point in time.
Well, you know, like a lot of people on December 8th, 1980, I had Monday Night Football turned on and the Miami Dolphins were playing the New England Patriots. And I would say probably most people heard about Lennon's passing from Howard Cosell.
Really?
Howard Cosell, there they are at the Orange Bowl. And, New England has just scored a touchdown. Now, this is going to become important in a little bit. So
okay.
The Patriots have just scored a touchdown. They're getting ready to kick the extra point, the conversion. Cosell comes on, and he says, "After all, you must remember this is only a football game. This news report just in from New York. John Lennon, perhaps the most famous of the Beatles, shot twice in the back, taken to Roosevelt Hospital, dead on arrival." Well, I didn't hear it because I had the sound turned down, a little sidebar. I had the sound turned down. My friend and I had just discovered the Beatles maybe a couple of years earlier. We were listening to the Beatles We had the Beatles turned up, so I didn't hear it. I went home.
So you were listening to the Beatles while they announced that Lennon had been assassinated.
I missed it. However, most North Americans heard it. So take you back to the White Album. Now, the first track on the White Album is Back in the USSR. Yes. The first line is, flew into Miami Beach. Okay, so remember, Miami playing in the Orange Bowl in those days against the New England Patriots. Now, the last cut on that album is, it's kind of a sound collage. It's called Revolution Number 9.
Yeah.
And very kind of experimental for its time, just sort of bits of found sound and all kind of stitched
together.
It's
a soundscape, basically,
it is. Now, near the end of that song, the end of that track, there's something that was recorded, I believe, in Liverpool at a soccer match, what they call over there football. And the crowd erupts in Block That Kick. Block That Kick. It's something you might hear at a football match. Mm-hmm. Just so happens, before Cosell's to announce, or as Cosell's announcing that Lennon has been shot, the New England Patriots are getting ready to kick the one-point conversion. The Orange Bowl erupts with Block That Kick.
Wow.
Block That Kick.
No kidding, huh?
I mean, music, rock and roll is just filled with, you know, those sorts of synchronicities. Again, if you're paying attention and you
right, like who would ever have found that out? You know what I mean? Like who would notice that?
Yeah, it's amazing to me every time I tell that story. I still get that tingle up my spine. Mm.
Something you would never know unless you pointed it out and were paying attention. So here, going back to the 27 Club, I looked it up and there's a lot of names on here. But like you said, it goes back to 1902. But you got the keyboard player from the Grateful Dead, and you got the bass player for the Stooges, and the guitar player from Badfinger, and not big names, but like bassist of Uriah Heep, big bands. Cecilia, she was a big star, a big singer in the 60s.
Right.
You know, so you're seeing a lot of these type of people, drummer for Echo and the Bunnymen, guitar player for Reba McEntire, keyboard player for Reba McEntire, Cobain. Yeah, so it's like the guitar player for the Manic Street Preachers. So once again, it's a lot of big name bands, even if it's not big name people, you know? So very interesting, very interesting. Guitarist for American Head Charge. I knew that band. The list goes on and on and on, though, man. It just continues and continues
It's quite impressive when you see the list. I think there's close to 100 people on that.
Even Anton Yelchin, who was Chekhov in the Star Trek reboot series and guitarist for the Hammerheads, died at 27.
He gets into the club then,
so he makes it to the, it's not a club that you want to be a part of, right? So you also mentioned another member of the 27 Club was Jim Morrison.
Yes.
And earlier when I asked you some thoughts you might want to have, you mentioned about Morrison's death in Paris.
A few years ago, I was down in the San Diego area, Corona Island, which is where Jim spent some time in his youth because his father was an admiral in the, in the Navy, and of course a huge naval base in San Diego. So I met his brother-in-law. Alan Graham was married to Jim's younger sister, I believe. And he told me, of course, you know, the family had lost track of Jim for many years because his father wanted Jim to, you know, join the Navy, and Jim had skipped out on his, you know, after he had been drafted, he skipped out on that. He was hanging out in Venice Beach, sleeping on rooftops. His father sent people after Jim. So the family had lost track of him,
Before the doors, basically, they really couldn't find him.
That's anywhere. Right, that's right. So they had lost track with him. He had sort of disavowed them. And, of course, that famous interview, when he was asked about his family, he said they're dead.
Mm-hmm.
So when Alan Graham finally, you know, discovered that Jim was part of his family, they went to meet him at the airport
this
in Los Angeles
Graham's
for the first time.
Brother-in-law?
Alan Graham, the brother-in-law.
Okay, gotcha.
And, of course, it's like stifling hot, and Jim's wearing those pony pants and the leather jacket, and he's got a scarf, and he's carrying this old beat up duffel bag or an attaché case with his lyric, you know, playing the part of the beat poet.
Right.
So that's how we met Jim Morrison, you know, when he had already established himself as a musician, and this was his brother-in-law. So he was telling me this, and so I asked him about, okay, so tell me about the final days. And he said, well, we got a call from Paris saying that Jim's dead, and he said my first reaction was, oh, here we go again, because there had been so many different reports.
Rumors and stuff, yeah.
But Pamela Corson, his wife at the time, didn't tell anybody until days afterwards. And then the moment that Jim was buried, she hightailed it out of there and flew back to the United States. But Alan told me about a hanger-on in Paris. He couldn't remember his name exactly, but he got wind of this German fellow by the name of Dieter, who looked like Jim, who dressed like Jim, who hung out at the apartment at the Paris flat with Jim and Pamela. And Jim liked to collect odd people. Mm. He found, you know, he would go into bars and he would hang out with people and they'd become fast friends for a couple of weeks and then he'd move on to someone else. So it seems like Dieter was one of these people. And occasionally he would wear Jim's clothes and go out and get free drinks at the bars. Everyone, oh, you're Jim, and he played along. So the question then arises when Pamela comes home in a stupor and finds Jim Morrison in the bathtub. Is it possible that that wasn't Jim, that that was this guy Dieter?
Hmm.
Of course, the other odd thing about the way Jim went in the bathtub was that his head was resting up against the bathtub faucet. Now, I take showers. I don't know about you, Chris, the last time you got into a bathtub, but who gets into the bathtub with their head?
I have had a bath in the past, and you go the other way.
Exactly. Yeah. Your feet are always facing the tap. So that's kind of an odd little incongruity. The idea that he somehow mistook some heroin for a cocaine or something and had a heart attack, got into the bathtub, died, expired there. It just doesn't add up that you would put your head against the taps. Of course, there's also the theory that he died at a nightclub, at the Circus Club on the Paris and on the Left Bank in Paris. It's like Disneyland. Nobody dies in the Circus Club, so bouncers took him back to the hotel and put him in the bathtub so that nobody would know. So it is shrouded in mystery. Alan Graham, though, still holds out a remote possibility that Jim Morrison faked his death.
Hmm.
He's not putting it, you know, he's not giving it odds like 50-50 or anything, but he said it's remote. If anyone could pull it off, it would have been Jim Morrison.
And that it was really Dieter that was found in the tub.
Exactly.
Really. You mentioned something interesting to me that I don't know is this an actual thing. If someone dies in Disneyland, do they cover it up?
That's what I've heard.
Really?
That's what I've heard. Yeah,
there's a whole other conspiracy.
Well, not that they cover it up, but that they will put you in a helicopter and fly you off of the grounds and before you're declared legally dead.
Interesting.
It's this apparently unspoken rule, or maybe it is written down somewhere that nobody dies at Disneyland.
It's the happiest place on earth.
Indeed.
You can't die at Disneyland.
Exactly.
Wow, man. You know, I love stories like this because, like I said, whether it's true, whether it's real, like what a food for thought, because the Jim Morrison legend was that he faked his death. He's one of the two, him and Elvis and a few others.
Sure.
Andy Kaufman.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
And just the thought of someone, I would like to meet somebody who faked their own death and like 30 years later go like, this, I can't take it anymore. Like, I'd like to know how you can even pull that off.
Well, Machiavelli did this apparently, and Greek philosopher, he was Greek, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like it.
Or was he Italian?
Maybe Italian.
I think he was
Italian. Greek, maybe.
That's right. So he, you know, great philosopher and politician. He supposedly pulled this off, and it's interesting. Tupac Shakur,
right.
Used the alias Machiavelli on occasion. And so, again, that feeds into the theory that Tupac Shakur perhaps faked his death.
So something that Gary and I spoke about was we were ending the podcast was he mentioned something about the Big Bopper. And I was like, what are you talking about? He's like, well, you've never heard that story before? And we kind of talked about it a little bit, how one of the rumors or theories is that somebody got shot on the Buddy Holly plane, which is why it crashed.
Right.
And you were going to tell me a little bit more in depth about that whole situation.
Well, there are a lot of mysteries surrounding the plane crash in Clear Lake, Iowa. One of them was that there was supposedly a pistol found, and Buddy Holly did carry a pistol. It's not unusual. I mean, because he got paid in cash when they played a club.
It was like the Wild West back in those days.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it would stand to reason. Now, the question was, you know, was there a gunshot fired? Did this cause the plane crash? I don't happen to think so. However, the other mystery was that when they found the wreckage and Richie Valens and Buddy Holly and the Big Bopper, J.P. Richardson's body strewn in the field, the Big Bopper was seated in the back. He was a big, husky guy. He's seated in the back of that tiny little cramped plane. And yet, when they found the bodies, his body was thrown forward. So his son, J.P. Richardson Jr., who toured up until his death, I believe in 2009.
Toured as the Big Bopper Jr.?
Toured as the Big Bopper, doing a tribute to his dad. He was born, he never got to meet his father because he was born 80 days after his dad died.
Wow, okay.
But it had always caused him such anguish to think, did my father survive the crash and somehow with his broken and wrecked body crawl to the front, you know, and then did he, is that how he died? There was so many unanswered questions. And so in Beaumont, Texas, where the Big Bopper was from, they decided to move his body from the cemetery to a more prominent place in the town to really celebrate and give the Big Bopper his due. And so his son thought, well, here's an opportunity. I'm going to request that my father's remains be exhumed, and I can get some answers to some of these questions. You know, maybe was there a gunshot fired? Is there evidence of a gunshot wound? You know, is it possible that my father survived the crash and then, you know, crawled to the front of the wreckage? So they take out the casket, and the medical examiner calls JP Jr. into the room and says, I want you to prepare yourself. We're going to open the casket. It's been almost 50 years. I believe it was 48 years. Since
what that happened in 56 or 57,
the crash that was in 1959, gotcha. February 3rd, and the body was exhumed in 2007, so 48 years. Prepare yourself. They open the casket. The medical examiner is absolutely stunned at what he sees, and J.P. Richardson Jr. can't believe it either. For some reason, after 48 years, the body is in near pristine condition. Right down to the trademark Big Bopper brush cut.
He still had his hair?
He had his hair.
How?
It's one of those mysteries.
Airtight casket or something?
I suppose if you want a more prosaic answer, it's the, you know, the environmental conditions were just so. It reminds me of these saints that are uncorrupted.
Yeah.
Even after several hundred years.
Or like a mummy or something where it's exactly. Like a completely mummified body, yeah.
So there's J.P. Richardson staring into his father's face. He's now older than his father was. His father is frozen in time. I believe he was maybe 30 when he passed, maybe a little bit younger. So to this day, the medical examiner, he goes on speaking tours, and he talks about this remarkable case of the Big Bopper being preserved intact. 100%.
That alone is fantastic. Like, what a thing.
But just the postscript was, and here's where the Big Bopper Jr. got some relief. Every bone, virtually every single bone in the Big Bopper's body was just pulverized. Mm. And so he was, rest assured, he was killed instantly, and there was no chance he survived the crash. And of wow. course, there were no gunshot wounds or anything of that sort. So
it was just a horrible mechanical problem that went wrong.
Correct. But, well, that part is still up in the air. Much of the wreckage, the plane wreckage, which was owned by the couple, now very old, in their 90s, I believe, they were the ones that chartered the plane to the pilot and Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and the Big Bopper. They only have certain pieces of that wreckage, and they say that some shadowy figures came by and hauled most of it away. Now, I'm not sure if they were from the FBI or from the CIA or where they were from, but they have some of the wreckage, but not all of it. The other theory is that perhaps the Big Bopper decided to change seats with Buddy Holly, and this big husky guy getting out of the back seat, trying to crawl into the front, could have caused the pilot to be distracted and crash the plane.
That happens, though. Like, when you go on smaller planes, as much as I travel, sometimes they'll say, hey, can two people move from the right side of the plane to the left side of the plane? We need the weight distributed properly.
Right.
That could be something.
Could have been a contributing factor.
Especially on such a small plane.
Could have been a contributing factor. Yeah. I know Peggy Sue Guerin a little bit. And Peggy Sue, of course,
The Peggy Sue.
High school sweethearts with Buddy Holly. They never married, but I'm pretty sure that, you know, that love really never died, despite the fact that Buddy Holly married later. And she married Jerry Allison the drummer, the original drummer in the Crickets.
Because Buddy Holly married a Mexican girl, Spanish lady, right?
Maria, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so, right. Yeah, so he never married Peggy Sue.
No.
Okay, yeah.
But that connection remained until the end. She swears up and down to me that there was some foul play. She believes that she's in communication with Buddy's spirit to this day, and he's intimated that it was murder. The motive, I'm not really sure. Either is she at this point. But she had premonitions in the weeks and days leading up to the plane crash, and she pleaded with Buddy, don't get on the plane, don't get on the plane. And he said, you know, Peggy Sue, it's safer up there than it is driving a car. So she learned of it driving back to Lubbock, Texas. On her way back to her house, there was a traffic mishap, and all of a sudden this body comes flying through the air and lands on her windshield. It was as if it had fallen from the sky. It turns out there was a trucker who had pulled over to the side of the road, got clipped, went sailing up into the air, and landed on the windshield of her car as she's driving back to Lubbock. And so they had to stop, and the police, of course, came, the ambulance. She gets home February 3rd, goes to bed, wakes up in the morning to discover that Buddy Holly had died in the plane crash. Just as she had remembered it, she told him, I see the plane going up, it comes down. And she talked about, you know, the farm fields and all of that stuff. And it happened just as she had dreaded and dreamt that it would. But this omen of on the way home, before learning of Buddy's death, this body seemingly falling out of the sky and landing on her windshield.
It's unbelievable.
Yes.
You know, the thing I was going to tell you about, Rich, is that it's interesting to me, like you mentioned, maybe Big Bopper moved on the plane. But, you know, Waylon Jennings was supposed to be on that plane.
Yes.
Did he lose a coin toss to Big Bopper?
He lost the coin toss to Ritchie Valens.
To Ritchie Valens.
Who, poor Waylon Jennings, for the rest of his days, he had to live with this fact that he and Buddy Holly were kind of verbally jabbing each other in a playful way. Waylon Jennings was on the winter tour along with Buddy Holly. He had broken up with the Crickets at this point.
Was Waylon playing with Buddy, or just on his own?
Well, there was he was one of the side men. There was Carl Bunch on drums. There was Tommy Alsip, and my gosh.
So there was no Crickets at that point in time. It was Buddy Holly and another band.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Ritchie Valens, the Big Bopper, of course. They played their last gig at the Surf Ballroom in Clear Lake, Iowa. And then they were heading to Minnesota. But they had been traveling on this bus through the Midwest in February. And there was no heat on this bus. So imagine someone of Buddy Holly's stature. At this point, he had done a world tour. He had toured Australia, but he had problems with the record company and so forth.
Typical story.
Right.
Yeah.
So they're on this horrible bus. And at one point, Carl Bunch, the drummer, has to leave. He gets checked into a hospital. He's got frostbite. I mean, they were lighting fires on the bus with bits of newspaper to keep warm.
Yeah.
So at a certain point, Waylon Jennings and Buddy Holly says, I'm chartering a plane. He says, I got laundry to do before we do the next gig in Minnesota. I'm going to fly ahead. Who's with me? Big Bopper said, well, I got the flu. I need a good night's sleep. I'm with you. One more seat left. So Waylon Jennings decides to flip for it with Ritchie Valens. Now, Ritchie Valens wins the coin toss.
There you go.
The coin, and I'm not even having the vodka.
I'm much more enunciation now.
So Ritchie Valens says, wow, this is great. I've never won anything in my life.
Wow.
Buddy Holly turns to Waylon Jennings and says, I hope you freeze on that bus tonight. And Waylon Jennings says to Buddy Holly, I hope your bloody plane crashes, you SOB.
Wow.
So imagine having to live with that. But the thing with Ritchie Valens was, you would have thought he would have been absolutely dreading the idea of getting on a plane. Because by all accounts, he was deathly afraid of planes. He lost a good friend to a plane crash. At his high school in Los Angeles, he used to serenade the girls with his guitar underneath this tree in the schoolyard. He played there every day at lunch, Monday to Friday. So one day, he happens to be sick or he's off, and what happens? A plane comes falling out of the sky and and crashes in that exact spot, killing one of Buddy's classmates, or Richie's classmates.
For real?
For real.
Wow.
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
Of all the places, it lands exactly where Richie Valens used to perform at the high school. So, you know, he had bad feelings about flying. So anyway, he wins the coin toss, and it wasn't much of a victory, obviously.
You know, you hear about that because I think the same thing happened with Clapton and Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Yes.
Where Clapton was going to take it and gave it to Stevie or vice versa along those lines. Another good one is, not good one, but Cliff Burton and Kirk Hammett coin tossing to see who gets the top bunk on the bus. They crash. Cliff dies because of the bunk he's in. Just the cruel hand of fate.
How history either way on the flip of a coin.
Yeah, on the flip of a coin. Mm. You mentioned Buddy Holly. We've been talking about Buddy Holly. You said there's a kind of a curse around Buddy Holly, around the passing of Buddy Holly. Tell me the story.
Well, not only did we lose, you know, the three musical giants in 1959, Richie Valens, the Big Bopper, and Buddy Holly. Buddy Holly was replaced on that Winter Dance tour by a guy by the name of Ronnie Smith. Ronnie Smith, a few years later, developed some nasty drug problems, was checked into a mental institution, and hanged himself. Hmm. Now, the Crickets, after Buddy Holly left, they reformed with Joe B. Maudlin and Sonny Curtis and Jerry Allison. They got a new singer by the name of David Box. They later became the Jitters. They recorded as the Jitters. And it was that incarnation of the Crickets that recorded Peggy Sue Got Married, which was the sequel to Peggy Sue.
Buddy Holly didn't sing that song?
Not to my knowledge. He didn't record it.
Really?
Yes, that's
right. I thought it was a Buddy Holly song.
It was recorded by David Box.
The Crickets or the Jitters?
That's right.
The Crickets. Okay.
The Crickets.
Wow.
So
that takes a lot of balls to do that. Eh?
Those are big shoes to fill. But David Box stepped into them. And so David Box now, at a certain point, leaves the Jitters or the Crickets, goes out on his own. A young Texan like Buddy Holly, charters a small plane, and at almost the same age, about 22, dies in a plane crash in 1964. So that's number two.
That's crazy.
It is, but I mean, it goes on and on. It's like the 27 Club. Now we have Eddie Cochran. Eddie Cochran was a huge Buddy Holly fan, and they were good friends.
Summertime Blues.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So Eddie Cochran is touring England along with Gene Vincent. They get into a car crash. Gene Vincent re-injures a knee that he had injured years before. He would walk the rest of his days with a bad limp. He died in 1971. Eddie Cochran is thrown from the vehicle, taken to a hospital, has massive head injuries. He's actually visited in hospital by the surviving Crickets, Joe B. Maudlin, Sonny Curtis, Jerry Allison. He dies the next day. Then we have Joe Meek. Now, Joe Meek, I don't think, gets his due. He was one of the most avant-garde experimental record producers who really elevated the position of record producer to an artist in and of himself. He was the guy that really created overdubbing and reverb. And a band that he produced, The Tornadoes, recorded a hit song called Telstar.
Yeah.
Which became the first British hit to hit number one on the Hot 100.
Instrumental, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
So in a way, and that started the ball rolling. So in a way, you could say that Joe Meek was sort of responsible for getting the British invasion rolling.
And also like surf music and all that stuff where it was just instrumental. Ventures and
that's right. Yeah.
Dick Dale, all that sort of thing.
Yeah, the Tornadoes.
Yeah.
And Joe Meek is, I mean, there's an episode just on Joe Meek. He was totally into the paranormal. He used to set up recording devices in cemeteries to try and capture EVPs or electronic voice phenomenon. He would record his cats. He believed that they were, you know, trying to communicate with him. Huge interest in the paranormal. At some point in 1958, Joe Meek goes to a tarot card reader and is somehow the conversation comes up about Buddy Holly. And the tarot card reader tells Joe Meek that Buddy Holly is going to die in a plane crash on February the 3rd, 1958. So Joe Meek is desperately trying to warn Buddy Holly. Well, February 3rd, 1958 comes and goes. Of course, nothing happens because it was a year later. She was off by a year. February 3rd, 1959.
Joe Meek is a lady?
No, Joe Meek
went to the tarot card leader. Okay.
That's right.
Wow.
So.
Jeez, man.
Joe Meek continues with his recording career, but he was absolutely obsessed with Buddy Holly. And at a certain point, we're not sure why, but Joe Meek just falls into a deep depression and a funk and almost has these psychotic episodes. February 3rd, the anniversary of Buddy Holly's death, Joe Meek takes a shotgun, murders his landlady, and then turns the gun on himself on the anniversary of Buddy Holly's death.
What year?
1967.
Okay, so the 8-year anniversary.
So there's Joe Meek. Boy, oh boy. I mean, it goes on. You could talk about Keith Moon, for example. Keith Moon died in Mayfair, a suburb of London, in September of 1978. The night before, he had been out with Paul and Linda McCartney attending the Buddy Holly story in London's West End. And, of course, on a sort of a sidebar, jeez, Keith Moon died in Harry Nilsson's flat in Mayfair, in the same room, in the same bed that Mama Cass had died in 1974. Now, if you're Harry Nilsson, you're thinking, my God, am I a jinx or what?
Yeah, or why am I sleeping in a bed where the lady choked on a sandwich?
That's right. So two musical legends died in Harry Nilsson's...
Harry Nilsson's bed.
That's right. That's right.
That's crazy.
So Harry sold the apartment. Who buys it? Pete Townsend, Keith Moon's bandmate, who obviously has no, you know, problems with ghosts or anything like that.
It's just like the same thing, like when Duane Allman dies in a motorcycle crash.
Yes.
I don't know the exact thing. I'm sure other people did. On the corner of 3rd and 5th.
Right.
A year later, I believe to the day, Barry... Oakley, I'm going to say Barry Gordy, the bass player.
Right. There's Dickie Betts and was it Oak?
Maybe Barry Oakley, maybe.
Barry Oakley.
He dies.
Yes.
A year later.
Yes.
In a motorcycle crash on the corner of 3rd and 5th.
That's right. The same location.
It's unbelievable.
Well, just back up a little bit because a year, almost exactly a year before Duane Allman died in that motorcycle accident, he had a drug overdose.
Mm-hmm.
He's rushed to the hospital. The band members are frantic. They gather at the hospital. The doctor comes out and says, I don't think he's going to pull through. This is not good. He's not responding. So, again, I believe it was Barry Oakley.
Yeah, man, I'm pretty sure. I'll Google it. But
he rushes out of the hospital, falls to his knees in the parking lot, and starts sobbing. And supposedly, this is the story, cries out to God and says, please, just give Duane one more year.
Wow.
And that's what he got. One more year.
And it is Barry Oakley, by the way. Unbelievable stuff. I mean, we mentioned Brian Jones earlier. Did you ever anything controversial about his passing?
Well,
it's kind of rumors and innuendo about that.
Yeah, Brian Jones died in his swimming pool at his estate in East Sussex, England, which, kind of an interesting side note, that that mansion was part of the old A.A. Milne estate. A.A. Milne wrote Winnie the Pooh.
Based on a character from Winnipeg.
That's right. There's a connection for
Winnipeg,
you, Chris.
Winnipeg the Pooh, yeah.
That's right. So it had always been assumed that he had just drowned.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps a little bit of a, you know, alcohol and drug cocktail precipitated things. Although the people that attended this pool party were very hush-hush.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody wanted to talk about what happened to Brian Jones back in, I think it was July of 1969. What's interesting was a couple of weeks prior. Now, he had been... asked to leave the Rolling Stones.
I think technically he's actually out of the Stones.
That's right, he is. Yeah. He appeared somewhat sporadically on Beggars and Banquets, mm-hmm, in 1968, or Beggars Banquet 1968. But by this point, his drug problems had just overtaken his musical abilities. So he was asked to leave. He did. But several weeks prior, Mick Jagger and Marianne Faithfull, who were both into, you know, Eastern mysticism and perhaps the occult, are playing around with the I Ching coins. And
what exactly are I Ching coins?
These are, I suppose, they're almost like, one might say, a way of predicting future events, somewhat like a tarot card, but this comes from China. So the I Ching coins are supposed to reveal future events.
Mm-hmm.
So what comes up is... Brian, death by water. They can't believe it. They try it again. It comes up again. Brian, death by water. Several weeks later, Brian Jones found a dead in his swimming pool. Now, Mick and Marianne feel horrible because they never said anything, but they thought, this is ridiculous. You know, it's not going to happen. Marianne Faithfull is so overcome with guilt and grief that she actually changes her physical appearance. She gets her hair cut in the Brian Jones style. I don't know if you remember that.
Bowl cut.
Yes, the straight bangs.
Yeah.
Exactly. And she starts having these episodes where, you know, Brian is haunting her dreams, and she claims when she looks in the mirror, she sees Brian Jones looking back at her.
She used to date Brian Jones at some point before Mick did. Is that correct?
I know that Anita Pallenberg
dated
both Keith
and
Brian, but it's possible.
I'm sure they're all messing around with everybody
in those days, sure.
So she sees him in the mirror.
That's right. That's right. Another interesting connection is Patti Smith, great New York artist, musician. And I mean, another era, but she has a strange connection with Brian Jones. She went to a Rolling Stone concert back in the mid-60s or early, maybe late 60s. She got up close to the stage. She almost got crushed. At one point, Brian Jones sees what's happening down below, is fearful someone's going to get hurt. He reaches out to her. She touches him. And ever since then, occasionally this will come up in an interview. She'll talk about, you know, how Brian Jones is guiding her career and has appeared to her in dreams and so forth. So yeah, Brian Jones has had kind of a strange spiritual connection with a number of artists from beyond the grave.
You know what's funny too? I think Dylan was actually at the last show that Buddy Holly played in Clear Lake.
That's right.
Because he talks about Buddy Holly looked at him.
That's
and
right.
And has been his muse or has been guiding his career or something on those lines, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
great
yeah.
story. That's right.
So just as we wind down here, there's a couple of other kind of odds and ends I wanted to talk about, because something that Gary mentioned was talking about the relationship of the occult, and specifically Aleister Crowley and Jimmy Page, or anybody in rock and roll, but I think it was more Page than anybody.
Yes. Well, Aleister Crowley, interesting, interesting guy. Was really a member of the aristocracy in England. His father was an engineer, but his ancestors had owned a brewery, so he never had to work. And so he liked to dabble in magic, and he had a penchant for prostitutes and alcohol and so forth. And he almost, I guess, in a way to rebel against his parents, who were very religious. They used to read Bible passages to him at the breakfast table. He would go out on on these all-night binges and rampages, and eventually found himself dabbling in witchcraft and the occult, and some would say Satanism and so forth, and wrote volumes about magic and occult and black magic and so forth in the occult. And Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin was absolutely enthralled with this. In fact,
was he the head of the Satanic Church at this point, Aleister Crowley? Or am I thinking of Anton LaVey?
Yeah, Anton LaVey.
Okay, so Aleister Crowley
was certainly a precursor.
He's more like a wizard and a
black. That's right. Yeah, and he died in the late 1930s.
Gotcha.
So it was before there was sort of a formal Satanic Church, but he had purchased a mansion in Scotland.
On the banks of?
Oh, Loch Ness, of course. Thank you.
Another mythical place.
Yes.
Yeah.
And eventually sold it. But Jimmy Page wanted to have some connection to Aleister Crowley, however tenuous. So he decided he was going to buy this house. And there are stories, not from Jimmy Page, because I don't think he spent a lot of time there with touring and so forth, but the people that worked there, the staff, all have stories. There was supposedly a beheading in this. It's like a medieval castle.
Castle, yeah.
And there was supposedly a beheading, and the staff, maids and so forth, report at night hearing what sounds like a head rolling. I don't know what a head sounds like rolling down the hall, but that's what they report. Jimmy Page has always been sort of tight-lipped about, you know, what's gone on there. He said he never saw or heard the head rolling down the hall, but he intimated that he's had experiences there, paranormal experiences there, ghost sightings, but he's never really elaborated on those. He eventually sold the castle as well in Scotland. Now, I believe it was Led Zeppelin III, a very famous quote from Aleister Crowley, and I believe it was a book title, his biography, is, do thou what thou will, which is kind of a credo, I guess, you know, among witches and Satanists and so forth.
Do what you want.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And Jimmy Page had that inscribed on Led Zeppelin 3.
Mm.
So, yeah, Jimmy Page has a strong connection to Aleister Crowley, and the whole sort of occult connection to rock and roll. Part of it is just showmanship. I think that's
dark side.
Certainly, I think, for example, with Black Sabbath, they used to, you know, they. I don't think they were serious occult practitioners necessarily. Many bands sort of played around with that. It was feeding into the image that, you know, rock and roll is taboo and it's not your grandparents' music and so forth. But with Jimmy Page, I mean, he was a serious, I think, devotee of Aleister Crowley.
Mm-hmm. Well, like I said, if you're going to buy somebody's house and there's rolling heads down the hallway, it's a little bit creepy for sure. Last couple questions. First of all, who's your favorite band?
It's got to be the Beatles.
Yeah.
And for me, when I first heard Revolver on stereo, specifically And Your Bird Can Sing, I thought, and this was in the early 80s, I thought, what planet?
Mm-hmm.
That album is 50 years old now, mm-hmm. as of last year. And it's still like miles ahead of like the harmonies and the bass line.
Everything.
And I just thought, my gosh, George Martin, I know, certainly had a hand in it, but you look at the evolution of this band in like 4 years,
mm-hmm.
2 years they land in the United States, and in 2 years they go from singing "She Loves Me, Yeah, Yeah, Yeah" to this.
Mm-hmm.
That's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1966, there were bands still doing the "Yeah, Yeah, Yeah," and they were just so
far ahead,
like another planet. And to me, that has just always fascinated me.
I was looking at this way with the Beatles, you know, basically 62 to 69 is their recording career. So you're dealing with a band that when they break up in 69,
yes.
two of them are 29, one of them is 27, one of them is 26. George is 26 when the Beatles break up. Like, talk about, like,
that's
where
right.
do you go from here?
That's right.
You know what I mean?
Live up to.
Unbelievable. That age of musicians with the musical maturity they had at 40, 50 years older.
Yes.
You know, it blows my mind as well.
It is remarkable.
And what's your favorite memory about Gary?
I think just hanging out with him over beer and whatever. I used to take him to Greek Town when he would come to Toronto. And so we'd hang out on the Danforth and eat some moussaka and have some beer or some red wine and just talk like you and I are talking. Mm. And just, you know, he was such a font of information and knew so many musicians. He would talk to me about Robbie Krieger from The Doors, and he knew the drummer that toured with Eric Clapton and trips he made down to the Crossroads, and just a really cool guy to hang out with. And I don't have one single memory. It's just basically sharing the same
mm-hmm.
air with him mm-hmm. in the same space.
You guys are kindred spirits.
We were. We mm-hmm. were. Yeah.
Are you going to keep his dream alive, his vision alive?
That's my mission.
Great. Rich, it's been great talking to you, man.
Chris, thanks for the
I'm
opportunity.
I'm pretty creeped out right now. I'm not getting on any small planes.
Please don't.
All right, the Rock and Roll Twilight Zone with Richard Syrett releases new episodes every Wednesday on the Jericho Network and Westwood One. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or Google Play or listen on TuneIn. Rich has already got another in-depth episode about the death of Jimi Hendrix. He just released a full episode with more detail on Buddy Holly, so you can hear the whole story with the day the music died. If you love mysteries and conspiracy theories and rock and roll, then this is the show for you. Subscribe now. The Rock and Roll Twilight Zone right here on the Jericho Network and Apple Podcasts on Westwood One. All right. Also, Chris Jericho Rock and Rest of Rage at Sea set sail October 27th. Still some cabins left at chrisjerichocruise.com. But after a big announcement of Kenny Omega, so many other announcements coming. We actually have four major talents coming up. And don't forget about the Ring of Honor, Sea of Honor tournament. For as low as $150, you can put your deposit down in your cabin. And once you book, everything is included in the price. You get to see Kenny Omega wrestle in the ring. You get to hang out with Jim Ross and Jerry Law, SoCal Val, Mick Foley, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, Rey Mysterio, Raven, Cyrus, and Paul Lazenby from Killing the Town, Conan, Disco Inferno, Shane Helms from Keeping It 100, Beyond the Darkness telling some scary tales, Cole Cabana, Marty DeRosa doing the Unprofessional Wrestling Show, Brad Williams, Ron Funches, Busted Open Radio, Fozzy, Phil Campbell, the Bastard Sons, King, the star of the Dave Spivak Project, the Cherry Bomb, Shoot to Thrill, Blizzard of Ozzy, so much stuff. and the Pièce de Résistance, the Ring of Honor Sea of Honor Tournament, which gets you a world title shot for the Ring of Honor Championship in the future. If you win it, Young Bucks will be in it. Marty Scurll, Briscoe Brothers, Dalton Castle, Frankie Kazarian, Adam Page, Crystal Daniels, Jay Lethal, American Nightmare, Cody Rhodes, Brandi Rhodes, Kenny Omega will be there. So many are going to be there. Go to ChrisJerichoCruise.com to find out all the information. Come join us. This cruise will sell out. Don't you dare miss it. Come and hang out. And don't forget to watch the Painless video on YouTube now. The Making of Painless also up on YouTube now. So much great stuff going on. We're so happy to have you here. Thank you so much for being here. And we will see you next Wednesday. And in the meantime, in the between time, stay hard, stay hungry, to Biggie. Yeah, boy. We'll see you next Wednesday, baby.